Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Taking a look at the world of wildlife right now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. And certainly it's always a fun Wednesday for me, the first Wednesday of the month when Scott comes by. And I know we always get lots of great questions about what's going on out there in wildlife. So I hope you'll join in with yours. 1-800-642-1234. Email talk@wpr.org. Scott, great to have you back.
Well, it's good to be here. And boy, am I thrilled that it's September.
Busy.
It's been busy, but I've also been suffering in this heat and humidity. I just don't care for it personally. But
I wish everyone could see the shirt you've got on today, because it's the Wisconsin Culverts Project shirt, and you just finished up a couple of those projects.
We just finished up two intensive four-day workshops up at the Kemp Natural Resources Station on Lake Tomahawk just this past weekend, and then 2 weeks before that. I know we recruited a few participants for that from mentioning it on the radio back earlier in the summer, and we just had two terrific groups of landowners. We had a great time. I think they learned a lot. We impacted somewhere between 5 and 10 or 15,000 acres of landscape, I think. And generally, they were great sessions all the way around. And we'll be doing at least one again next summer. So for folks who hear more about this or see it in their various newsletters or other venues, something to think about for next August. But the workshops went very, very well.
I know a good friend of mine, Kurt Westbrook, did that a couple of years back, and he still talks about it. He said it was just absolutely wonderful as a participant. He really, really enjoyed it.
We run into people all over the state all the time who have been through it. We have about, somewhere over 500 cooperators now, as they're called. And the purpose of the whole thing is to build this core of landowners who are not only doing a great job of stewardship on their own property, but they're willing to help us get the message out to the broader community, their friends and neighbors and cousins and uncles and their hometown, essentially, to get the word out that forest stewardship, wildlife stewardship requires a little of effort, but it's a good thing to do.
Patricia in Portage has a question or comment for you. Let's go to Patricia.
Hey, the morning dove hunt starts today, and it's a bag limit of 15 doves per day per hunter, and 140,000 doves will be killed on average during that season. The bear hunt starts a week from today. They've issued 8,900 licenses to kill bears. Two-thirds of the bears killed will be babies killed over packs of dogs, which have been run across the northern part of the state for 2 months, so that bears don't even have time to get a little fat on before they're killed or before they hibernate. And, my comment is that as long as killing licenses fund the DNR, which Aldo Leopold warned against, and the general public is not involved, they want funding from us in the sales tax, so there's no power that goes with it. But the rest of the public has doubled wildlife watching in the last decade while hunting is declining. We need a funding source and a say from the public that don't kill wildlife, who are the majority. We bring 11 times the revenue to state and local tax coffers through wildlife watching and have never had a say in wildlife management and don't know anything because the media is all about killing.
Well, Scott, how do you respond to that?
Well, I couldn't agree more that more funding would certainly be desirable and from a broader base of the state citizenry. But I couldn't agree less on the notion that the DNR responds to no one other than the hunting constituency, or that their funding is entirely for license sales. If the caller just mentioned 8,900 bear permits, that's a big increase over the last couple of years. Why? Because the DNR funded a study in 2008 that determined that we had at least two, if not three times as many bears as we thought we had. So they quickly responded by issuing more permits to try and get the bear population down to a level that would minimize some of the conflicts and issues that are going on in the North Country where most of the bears are located. And as you well know, we talked on the last program about all the bear sightings now occurring in southern and southwestern Wisconsin. So, yeah, there are some points there, but the reality is hunting is a very strong tradition in Wisconsin. And even though the majority of people do not hunt, if you think about you hunt, I hunt, I don't apologize for that. I still think it's a valid form of recreational use of the wildlife resource. But the hunters, if you start to think about their siblings, children, spouses, and extended family, a great, well, I don't want to say a majority, but I'll just say a large number of people in Wisconsin are indirectly involved, perhaps tolerant of it, perhaps supportive, perhaps not. But the issue is, it is a big deal in Wisconsin. It has a strong social tradition. It's very important in the scheme of wildlife management. And we will talk about the dove situation in a few minutes, I think. But for right now, that's enough on that matter.
We have a question from Keith in Wanakee, who wants to ask if anything came of your conversation last month of a woman convinced of her sighting of an immature cougar. Remember that comment?
Vaguely, that it's really tough to keep the cougar situation straight, Larry, because there's so much going on. And in fact, if you want to get into it now, the DNR has come out with a recent news release where DNA analysis has confirmed four different animals in the state within the last 2 years. So this starts back with the Milton cougar that was ultimately killed in Chicago by police, and talks about the Dunn County animal and one up near St. Croix and other such sightings, which are confirmed now with DNA evidence. So there's no longer any debate that there are cougars around. There is some question about whether we've ever had any reproduction in this state, but they're looking into that. There's a great deal of attention being paid to cougars, and a management plan, kind of a response plan, will be forthcoming. I think the situation's well in hand, and the sightings will continue, especially now that there's confirmation that the animals are out there. And I'm sure there are more than the four that have been documented. Mm-hmm. But where they are and how many they are and whether they'll prove to be much of a management concern in Wisconsin remains to be seen, because I think it'd be a good long time before they can be considered numerous or widespread, even to the level of wolves with a population of 700 and some.
I want to go back to warm and wet. You were talking about warm and the month of August was warm and it was wet across a good share of the state. Any impacts on our wildlife, do you think, from that?
Well, for one thing, I think wildlife, like many of the humans around my neighborhood, are probably suffering from blood loss because the mosquitoes are so darn thick. But there are some spin-offs like that. But the reality is that especially in the North Country, where they've suffered through 4 or 5 years of extended drought, it's just great to be up there and see the seepage lakes filling up again, to see high water levels in the flowage lakes, to see the rivers running almost at spring canoeing levels in some cases. It's just really nice. And I think that that will have a kind of a salvation effect on things like amphibian populations and so forth that had been suffering, even some of the reptiles like turtles and whatnot. And there's just more water on the landscape for all the animals that can use it or benefit from it, and all that goes along with water-based recreation in the North Country. Now, in the South, we've had even more rain, but certainly enough, if you look around, it's a world of corn right now, and holy mackerel, is it ever tall, as is the giant ragweed in my backyard. So it's been a pretty good growing season for most things. That bodes well for fall food supplies and whatnot for wildlife. It's likely the harvest will be fairly early because of the advanced growing season. So there'll be waste grain out there, and from the hunting standpoint, corn will be down, which often provides some concealment for things like deer and makes them more difficult to hunt. All in all, it's been a pretty good thing.
Pretty good thing, although I will say there's still, the North still needs water, and it's going to take a few years, I think, of good rains to sort of get back up to the previous levels.
It certainly will, and this is all, of course, painted on the canvas of the somewhat scary projections of future water levels under global climate change, which, you know, 50 or 70 years out for northern Wisconsin look to be pretty low.
Pretty
but
low.
But we'll see.
We'll see. Ann in Portage, let's go to you now. Hi, Ann.
Well, hello. I have a strange question because I live on a lake in Portage, and I must say we have listeners in Portage, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I saw something last night that I have never seen in my life. I was sitting in my living room, and there was so much activity in the yard of these, whatever they were. There was a couple of dozen of these. I don't know what they were because I tried to look through my binoculars, but they were going so fast, I couldn't see what they looked like. Looked about as big as a hummingbird, but they weren't hummingbirds, and they were swooping sort of like bats do, feeding in the evening. Would you have any idea what they were?
Well, there have been lots of accounts this year of, in addition to the mosquitoes doing very well, there have been lots of accounts. In fact, Phil Pelletieri, our colleague, was on the news last night talking about large populations of butterflies. And I think what you probably saw, he also alluded to in talking about a real population boom in the larger dragonflies, which are every bit as big as a hummingbird, in fact, longer and wider. And they often seem to feed in swarms. They dart around grabbing insects. And I wouldn't be at all surprised, especially near a lake, if that's what you saw.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Well, thank you very much, because I was just totally mystified.
Well, the big dragonflies are really beautiful, very aerobatic, interesting creatures. So everybody's enjoying them this year. And they eat a lot of mosquitoes. So
they're great. Give
them a break.
But you know what? They weren't even afraid of me.
No, they're oblivious to a human around.
Yard, because I was hoping one would land so I could see it.
Mm-hmm.
Never did. But they were swooping around me, and it was kind of glorious. But I wish I could have seen one closer. But they were big.
I'm pretty sure that's what you were observing.
And we've had them in our yard on the lake, and it's been just a lot of fun this summer to watch them in action. Getting rid of some, but not all, of the mosquitoes.
No, not all.
Thanks, Ann, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, Talking Wildlife, with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. And John and Stoughton will turn to you next. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning, everybody.
Morning.
I just wanted to, I'm not sure if this is Scott's under his bailiwick or not, but are there any suggestions about what we can do to keep the voles and the moles under control?
Moles and voles.
Yeah.
Well, the moles have been pretty active recently as the soil's dried out a little bit, so I've got lots of mounds of soil and raised ridges on my trails through the prairie when I'm mowing, but the mole situation is going to resolve itself fairly quickly here, because as soon as we start to get cold weather and the soil chills, and especially the surface freezes, those moles will go down deep in the soil column to stay below the frost line. So you could certainly do a little mole trapping if you were so inclined still with either there are several different types of commercial mole traps available, or you could still consider an application of some of the castor oil-based repellents that are also pretty effective, but that can get a little expensive, and if the... I guess what I'm getting at is with the moles, if you can tolerate the problem for another 4 to 6 weeks, it's going to start to disappear on its own, and then just be prepared to deal with them next spring. On the vole front, however, and by voles, not moles, but voles, we're talking about a small field rodent. People call them field mice, although they're not really mice, technically speaking. They're voles. They have a blunt face and a short tail. And the most common one, the meadow vole, can reach incredible densities in grass. And with the lush growth we've had this year, I would think this would be a pretty darn good year for them. The problems with those animals really don't start until the mole problems are beginning to wane. So voles do most of their damage over winter beneath the protective blanket of snow. So if you've got Christmas trees, woody landscape plants around the house, a few dwarf fruit trees, anything like that that are in a matrix of grass, you need to be a little worried about those things being damaged by voles, which will chew the bark off at the root collar, at the ground line, over winter. So the time to control voles, either by trapping with mouse traps or whatnot, mm-hmm. which is labor-intensive given the number of animals there can be, or by the use of rodenticides, which are specifically designed for vole control, all of that has to be done between now and the time snow flies in order to knock the population down before the damage can occur.
There aren't any rodenticides for moles with an M, then. It's just scaring them away or whatever. What does the castor oil do? Scares them away?
Apparently there's a repellent effect to it, and they'll simply leave the area. But the one thing you might try, if you're interested, you'd get very quick results. There are several relatively new products on the market where there is essentially a toxicant. Moles aren't rodents, so it's technically not a rodenticide, but a poison infused, interestingly enough, into what looks like a gummy worm. You know, the candies, it looks like a candy nightcrawler. So you can buy these at local outlets, I think Farm and Fleet and the garden centers, places like that carry them. And just ask for the mole worms. And so you get a package. I think they come in six packs of these gummy worms that look like a worm, taste like a worm, apparently smell like a worm, but they're toxic. And you put your finger into the mole tunnel, the raised ridge that you can find easily enough, until it breaks through, and then slide this fake worm in there and cover it up. And the mole comes along and, hey, it smells like a worm, looks like a worm, tastes like a worm, and eats it, and that's the end of him. So that might be worth a try. And the other thing that actually surfaced on the program earlier in the season were folks having really good luck trapping them by excavating, say, a foot-long section of the tunnel and then putting a plain old rat trap in the excavated tunnel, baited with a piece of bacon, and then covering the whole thing with a big wash tub so it was dark. And I've had people calling me ever since we talked about that on the program saying, yeah, we caught a bunch of them that way. So there are your options.
There are your options. Thanks a lot, John, for calling. Appreciate it. Jason in Appleton, we'll get to you in just a minute. But to remind you, you are listening to The Wonderful World of Wisconsin Wildlife on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some more calls as we visit with Scott Craven. Jason in Appleton, you're next. Hi, Jason. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I have a quick question. I just got back about a week or so ago. Every year in August, we do a four-day paddling trip on the Namekagon in St. Croix up in northwest Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, normally this is a wildlife gold mine. There's usually just ducks and blue herons and especially eagles. And this year was the first year, obviously, the water was way higher. I talked to a local, and he said it was the highest they'd seen in over a decade. So the water was very high, and we saw a few eagles, but almost no blue herons and almost no ducks, and it's very odd. And I'm just wondering if my suspicions that it was because the water is too high, if that would be the reason.
Or just too much water.
Well, I think there's a couple things going on, Jason. I think with all the water around the landscape for a change, many of these animals, like the herons and the eagles and so forth, they're just spread out a little more. They've got more hunting grounds rather than depending on the permanent river flows. I'm going to say we talked a minute ago about the two workshops I just finished up on the Minocqua chain, and holy cow, it seemed like there were eagles all over the place. And quite a few herons along the road and flying here and there. So the duck situation may be slightly different. Some of the early dry conditions and so forth had depressed some duck populations a bit, but I'm not sure that was enough to explain what you were seeing. I think it's more of a result of the current water levels.
Yeah. And herons, you've got some interesting stories about herons, Scott.
Well, this is a chance for us to kind of call on the audience to chime in. I know we had one call perhaps a couple of years ago where an individual had said, it's interesting heron behavior. The heron learned to walk up from the lake into their backyard and stand by the bird feeder, stock still, where it would grab chipmunks, of all things. And we talked a little bit about that. Well, anyway, at one of the recent sessions up in the Northwoods, an old friend came up with some photographs of a heron standing next to a bird feeder on a lake just south of Minocqua. And the story went that the owners of the home had taken these pictures over time, but the heron did learn that it would walk up to the feeder, stand there stiff as a board. Chipmunk would scurry out to grab a seed. The heron would grab the chipmunk in its bill, carry the squirming chipmunk back to the lake, submerge it, and then flip it up in the air and swallow it. And they had stopped counting at, I think it was 24 or 25 chipmunks, until the heron said, well, the chipmunk hunting here has gotten a little thin, and moved on to greener pastures. But that's a really interesting behavior, and I was sort of curious if other folks who live along the water have seen the same thing.
Yeah, it'd be fun to know. And this is a day, by the way, before we go back to the phones, of the anniversary. It's an anniversary.
Well, it's kind of a dismal one in the history of wildlife. This was the day in 1914 when Martha, the last known live passenger pigeon, passed away in the Cincinnati Zoo. So as far as we know, that marks the date that passenger pigeons became extinct, and they'd been extinct in the wild before that. But, you know, here was a bird that there are many accounts in Schorger's early writings of the wildlife of early Wisconsin in his book on passenger pigeons, that here was a bird so numerous that it darkened the skies, and countless millions of them were shipped into markets for human consumption. Hard to imagine such a bird could have been driven to extinction, but it was. And this is the anniversary of the death of the last one, 96 years ago. I guess it raises, there was a comment made earlier about the fact that this morning is the opening of the dove hunting season.
Yeah.
And doves and passenger pigeons looked very similar, although passenger pigeons were much more numerous. As you recall, when the dove season was put in place a few years ago, there was great concern and hand-wringing that this would have serious consequences for the dove population. But that has not proven to be the case. And even though we very well know what happened to passenger pigeons, that kind of circumstance simply could not happen anymore, given the scientific approach we use toward wildlife management, the population monitoring that goes on, hunter concern in and of itself, and agency regulations. So if anything did start to look suspicious in the mourning dove situation or any other game species, the season would simply be closed, as we're seeing this fall coming up for antlerless deer hunting in the northeastern part of the state. It's a somewhat parallel situation, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But anyway, Martha died 96 years ago today.
96 years. Bill and Madison, let's turn to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Two things. First of all, the woman who called up about the dragonflies earlier, I'm from Louisiana originally, and we call them mosquito hawks down there. They're sort of the honorary state bird. And they get numerous with the mosquito population. And with more mosquitoes, you get more dragonflies and bigger dragonflies. And down there, it was not unusual to see 8-inch wingspans on dragonflies.
Whoa.
And nobody would bother them because they ate, they ate like 2-3 times their weight in mosquitoes every day, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I live out on near Cottage Grove Road on the east side, and there's a small wooded area that's undeveloped. And out of that every morning is there's a group of three birds, I think are cranes. They're huge. I've gotten close enough to get pictures of them, and they're taller than I am, and I'm over 6 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
There's a male, a female, and what looks like a young'un.
Mm-hmm.
And they make the sound sort of like it's kind of like a cross between a turkey and a duck. I don't know. They're brown. The male has like a red comb. It looks like a red comb of some kind on top. Is that some kind of a crane?
Yeah, those are sandhill cranes, and it's pretty common here in late summer to see a pair of birds from their resident wetland with one youngster, which is usually a little more brownish in color than the gray adults. And they are very tall, and they're very conspicuous. They wouldn't be real keen on the wooded area, though. There's got to be some open space there where they're coming out of a wet area or crop field or something where you're seeing them.
There is a field near where you see them in this field eating what look like,
right.
I don't know, they're eating things out of the grass, and they're surprising. I worry about them a little bit. I live on a dead-end street, and they're not timid at all. They go up and down the street in people's lawns eating what they can eat, and they just walk up the street and then back down the street.
That is unusual, isn't it, Scott?
Well, that's a little unusual. A lot of animals have adapted very well to the urban environment, and maybe cranes are starting to as well. But I wouldn't worry too much about them. They're capable of taking care of themselves. They've got that long beak that is pretty intimidating. And overall, the sandhill crane population in the state is doing very, very well. So it's a cool observation, and nice thing to see in a neighborhood like that. I wouldn't be too concerned about them.
All right.
And as far as the dragonflies are concerned, boy, those 8 inches, those would be big ones. But I think that we talked a little bit about water impacts. Dragonflies, of course, lay their eggs on submergent vegetation in the water. And then their larvae are voracious little things. Of course, we call them helger mites for fishing bait. But I think the fact that there's a lot of water on the landscape has also been good for the dragonflies. And the heat has probably accelerated their intergenerational time. So, there are a lot of them around.
Thanks, Bill, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Ryan and Cable a chance to join in. Ryan, hi.
Hi there. I had a question. I'm on the road a lot in Douglas County with my job, and I've been noticing the whitetails anywhere from like a red coat to some that look like they're in November already.
Mm-hmm.
Is that habitat related or is that genetic?
Well, it's that time of year. The summer coat for these animals is a very thin, rusty reddish brown coat, and then as we start to get into the fall and the day length is changing and it's cooling off, they'll make the fairly slow transition into the much thicker grayish-brown coat that we're far more familiar with during the winter, the hunting season, and so forth. So the transition from summer coat to fall coat, or conversely in the spring from winter coat to summer coat, is a gradual process. And they look kind of ratty-looking during the course of the transition, but it's a perfectly normal thing.
Yep.
Okay, because some have just looked like, they all got it already, and then some are blotchy, and then some are red. And I was just wondering if that's just based on their genetics, or...
It's a matter of individual variation, much as the same thing, and all the things vary with people from hair color to how fast your hair grows and a whole host of other things. So, yes, there's some variation among deer, and I guess you could attribute that to their genetic makeup. But there's probably other things related to their diet and age and a whole host of other things that may be involved.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Paul in Shawano, we turn to you now. Hi, Paul.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How's it going today?
Great.
Hey, I'm going to be a combination of both these last questions. I do a lot of traveling, and I end up going to Horicon and then out towards Portage and then down by, like, the Wisconsin River. And we've got a ton of sandhill cranes around Shawano.
Mm-hmm.
But when I travel, I see white cranes. Are there white sandhill cranes, or could those be whooping cranes?
Well, those could be whooping cranes. The restoration is underway, but if you're seeing something that looks like a crane, but it's snow white and has a little black on it on the wingtips or whatever, then that's probably in your sightings. I'd report that to local DNR folks just so they can keep track of where those sightings are coming in.
Because I know they have that on the website where it's for, like, the deer, and then I did get on there for some information, I just didn't want to give them false information, but they're far enough away, there's no other white cranes around.
Well, I mean, that's not altogether true. There are white wading birds. There are several different egrets, for example, that are snow white and are pretty good size, but probably not quite as large as a whooping crane would be.
These were definitely cranes, and they were really big, very similar to the the sandhill and height and everything. So,
well, I mean, the crane program is ongoing. Everybody gets excited about Operation Migration when the cranes are led south by the ultralight aircraft and they come back on their own and so forth. So there are some whooping cranes scattered around, but again, there's still that's an unusual sighting. And for the folks who are managing that program, I think they'd like to know where those birds are being seen.
Because it was, one was a Horicon, and then I saw one, it's like when you go south of Portage, it gets kind of swampy in there, and they're far enough off the road, I couldn't see the black, but I definitely would probably report
that. They would appear primarily white, and if you're sure they were big enough to have the stature of cranes and weren't egrets, then again, that's something I'd report. And there are many opportunities to get that kind of information into the system. We talked the last time about... I think it's called Operation Deer Watch, which is receiving a strong following now. There's the Wisconsin Nature Mapper website for reporting these kinds of observations. But I think in the case of this, it's just worth a phone call to the local DNR office and say, hey, this is where I've been seeing these cranes.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dave in Oconomowoc has this question for you, Scott. When camping in state forests, I catch and release, but occasionally keep a fish or two. What's the best way to dispose of the fish guts? Bury or toss in the woods away from people or what?
Well, that's that's a bit of a delicate question, you know, especially on public lands. Disposal of fish guts by just kind of pitching them in the woods, even though they're organic and they're going to be eaten up overnight by raccoons, I think could be construed by some as littering. And they can be pretty smelly until they are cleaned up. So it's possible that could be offensive to other state forest users and so on. I think that the party line on that would be to take those fish entrails, wrap them in plastic, and dispose of them in a suitable trash receptacle. That has its own problems associated with it. So I can't speak much to the legality of it here. I know as a fisher person, well, this is a delicate situation. But, you know, on land, there are a gazillion scavengers that are going to clean those up. And in the water, the turtles and so forth also eat. But I think that the technical point there is that either dumping them in the lake or strewing them in the woods is considered littering and not something that is condoned.
And he had a second question. When we catch red horse or other rough fish in the river, should we remove them from the river or release them?
Well, you know, this is another good one. In my childhood days in New England, when we were fishing in trout streams with my dad and he'd catch a yellow perch, he'd utter something uncomplimentary and throw the perch in the woods, and I thought that was what you did. And then I moved out here to Wisconsin and started seeing all these signs about perch fry and yellow perch fillets. I said, what's going on here? Who would eat those things? And gee, it turned out they were pretty good. So you know, different places have different sets of ethics. But in terms of removing something from the stream because it's an invasive species, that's one issue. You know, there may be cases where there's actually some merit to doing this. In the case of where you just think, well, these are competing with other fish in the stream that I'm more interested in, that probably removing that one individual or a couple individuals isn't going to make a whole lot of difference. Probably better to put them back in the stream and let things sort themselves out. I don't know what the policy is on that for some rough fish species. There are harvest regulations for rough fish. There's a separate pamphlet on that. You know, they can be netted in the winter in low oxygen situations and harvested in other ways. I think that's probably a question, if Dave's concerned, I'd run that by the local fish manager.
On to Jim in Saukville. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Say, we have a pond about 35 acres. It's very shallow. And a couple of years ago, we had some beavers move in and, you know, build a hutch. And I had a trapper come out and trap them. My wife was very upset at that. And the beavers are back. And I'm wondering, is there a way to live trap beavers?
Sure. There are there are several types of traps which are collectively called suitcase traps. They look like a big clamshell, essentially made of chain link, and they operate like closing a suitcase. There's one's called the Bailey trap. There's another one called the Hancock trap. And those were widely used when beavers were not as abundant or as widespread as they currently are. And they would be caught alive like that at a site of a nuisance problem or culvert damming or something, and then moved to a site where, hey, a few beavers would be a welcome addition. That hasn't happened much recently simply because there are a lot of beavers and a lot of issues and problems caused by beavers, particularly in northern part of the state. So that's kind of the backbone of the USDA Wildlife Services program in northeastern Wisconsin is removing, trapping nuisance beavers, getting rid of the dams, and so forth. I suspect that there are ways, if you wanted them removed alive, I'd work with your local wildlife manager. There are independent contractors out there who solve wildlife problems, that if you called one and said, hey, I got some beavers, but I want them out of here alive, I suspect they can do that for you. Mm-hmm. But the question that's then going to face, or the issue that then is going to face them, or potentially you, is where the heck are those beavers going to be released?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the problem with translocating live nuisance wildlife around the countryside. Theoretically, you need the written permission of the property owner at the recipient property. And if you could, you know, if you had a friend with a suitable habitat or whatnot, and they say, oh, I wouldn't mind having a couple of beavers around, then fine, I think you're good to go. But they should not be released even on state property, on public property, without the permission of the property manager.
Yeah.
But I think catching them alive and moving them is doable. You just have to locate the right person and go from there.
There you go.
I looked, on the internet and found out that their favorite food is water lilies, and we have a lot of water lilies. But we go away in the wintertime, and when we came back this spring, you know, they had felled, maybe 10 trees and stripped the bark off of them.
Well, and that's actually their preferred food is going to be the bark of aspen and birch and things like that. So if you're concerned about the tree felling and loss of trees, then that's one of the things that gets beaver into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. There you go. Good luck. You got some decisions to make there, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Gary emailed in, Scott, to ask why you can't purchase an exterior zone permit and a Horicon tag.
That's one of the decisions you have to make. If you're a goose hunter, you decide when and where you want to hunt, and it's a matter of distributing the resource. There's a limited number of geese allocated, especially in the migratory population, by agreement with the other states and provinces within the flyway, and then the DNR allocates a certain number of tags amongst the Horicon zone, the other zones that have tags, and then kind of the rest of the state is left as a bit of a grab bag, you're referred to as the exterior zone. And if you choose to hunt in the exterior zone to take advantage of the more liberal hunting opportunity and bag limits, that's your choice. But it's kind of you can't have your cake and eat it too situation. So it's a matter of allocation of the resource, and that's the way they've chosen to do it. And by the way, this morning also marked the opening of the early southeastern Wisconsin goose season.
That's right.
Which is designed to help stem some of the growth in urban-suburban populations. And I don't know how that's going, but I imagine there were some folks out there pursuing them this morning.
Susanna and Merrill, on to you. Hi, Susanna.
Hi. I just would like to make a quick comment about the disposable of the fish guts that you were talking a little bit earlier. I'm an environmentalist, and I can't just see putting them in a garbage bag and into the garbage, where it actually smells, too.
I understand.
And then goes into the landfill. I mean, my preferred choice would be that they make a shallow hole and put a little dirt over it, and it doesn't smell. And it goes back to the earth. Fish guts are wonderful fertilizers.
Yeah.
Or else the person can take them home and put them in the garden.
Yeah. Well, that's...
That would be a much better solution than putting them in a plastic bag.
Well, I'll just tell you, when I'm cleaning fish at home, I do bury all my fish entrails in my garden. But I think that the question from the caller here was, this was disposal in a state forest situation on public land. And there, I think there are other issues there. This is a case where we're going to have to call our lifeline, Gary. if there's someone out there representing
the DNR,
Parks Management or Forest Management or the DNR who can clarify the letter of the law on this, especially on public property, I think it would be helpful. But I think there's pretty much universal agreement, regardless of what we hear on the letter of the law, that this is a, you know, it's a biodegradable source of nutrients and whatnot.
Yeah.
That, and when we don't need to add things to the landfill. But I think there are other issues on public lands or waters that are at stake here. So if somebody can clarify this for us, please do.
Thanks for calling, Susanna. Appreciate your call. And I agree with you, Susanna, as well. We have an email from Jeff. Someone told me that spreading lime in my yard will kill the grubs that the moles are feeding on, therefore controlling the mole population. Effective?
Well, there are a number of soil additives. The one that used to be used was diazinon before it was banned. Lime may very well do the same thing in terms of either repelling or killing the grubs, earthworms, and other soil invertebrates that the moles are interested in. However, two problems. Number one, do you really want to kill all the invertebrates or remove all the invertebrates from your soil that are aerating and creating castings and doing other things that may be beneficial to the soil and the turf? That's one problem. The other problem is that indirect tactics like that take a long time to pay off. So you treat your lawn, and then it takes a while, yes, before things are either driven off or killed. And then it takes a while for the moles to figure, hey, what happened to all the grubs? It's time to leave. And people being people, most of them aren't that patient. And thirdly, I would just say that kind of an application at this time of year probably would not have time to pay off before the moles are going down anyway. So
there you
go. A couple things to think about.
You can join in, by the way. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. 1-800-642-1234. Valerie of Burnham Wood saw a white turkey in a flock of wild turkeys, mm-hmm. and that's kind of a rare event.
It is, but the problem, of course, is there's two possible explanations.
Oh, yeah.
One, of course, is an albino or a leucistic wild turkey, which is possible, and there have been some, even hunters have harvested some, and that's a big picture opportunity. But, of course, there's also the possibility that a domestic turkey has flown the coop, so to speak, and taken up as a consort with the wild birds. So it's a neat thing to see, but I can't say for sure which of the two alternatives we're dealing with.
Okay. We have some more callers online, so let's go to Kevin and Wanakee next. Kevin, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have a question about the mountain lions that have been seen in this area and what the state status and position on that animal is.
Well, the mountain lion or cougar situation is in a state of rapid transition. The big event, of course, these sightings have been going on for years. And probably in retrospect, some of them were certainly valid. But the first documentation occurred in 2008 with a DNA analysis. And since then, as we mentioned a little earlier, four different sets of sightings have been confirmed through DNA evidence. So there's no question that there are cougar or mountain lions around. Whether they're passing through, whether they're resident, whether they're breeding, still a fair bit of uncertainty. But the response is basically the formation of a cougar working group in the state that consists of a number of different people with knowledge and concern about mountain lions. A draft management plan either is or has been prepared. There's a team at UW-Stevens Point that has been analyzing and summarizing the sightings for years, and there's certainly a rapid response whenever a cougar is documented in terms of attempting to track it, even attempt to capture it and put a radio transmitter on it and learn more about these animals. Most of the animals, if not all so far, have proven to be young males, and it may be a while before a breeding population would be established. Female cougars could certainly arrive in Wisconsin, but I think the thinking is that that's a ways down the road, since we have no confirmed sightings that I know of reproduction up to this point. So anyway, the DNR has been collecting reports of observations for almost 20 years, and it's an ongoing process. But as I said earlier, I think we're a ways away from them being considered abundant enough to warrant a great deal of concern other than the immediate level of curiosity on the part of the public and the potential problems when there were livestock concerns. The one in, I think it was in Juneau County. Let me see here. I have some notes on this. Yes, the incidents that took place in Juneau County over the past several months. This was a case where a hunter reported seeing a cougar attacking a cow. The cow had to be put down. And then later in the general area, there were attacks on horses and sheep that were documented. And at the time, that was believed to be the cougar the hunter had seen. However, after interviewing and a whole lot of effort to attempt to find or track or identify this animal, nothing materialized. And all of the evidence was eventually submitted to a panel of four cougar experts from around the United States. And based on what they saw, they could not come up with any confirmation. So I think there's some thinking that this particular incident, even though it stirred up a lot of interest, may not have been a cougar at all.
No.
I don't know what it was, but may not have been a cougar. So, sure, there are sightings around. There are a few animals around. They're probably coming to us from the western parts of the Dakotas and the Black Hills. And what will happen over the next few years will be a very interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, no doubt. Are there any other smaller cats in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, there are a lot of the bobcat population's doing pretty well. The cougar population we've just talked about. Our third wild cat is, of course, the lynx, which is a very rare species. And at any given time, there may not be any in Wisconsin. They tend to move down periodically from the north. So that's a very rare animal. But, you know, by far, the sad reality, sad in my mind, is that the most abundant cat on the landscape are feral domestic cats, of which there are many, 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 and which, you know, I don't want to open a can of worms here, but in terms of impact of cats on other wildlife, the feral cat's probably the biggest player.
Biggest player. Okay, there you go, Kevin. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And oh, we got Al in St. Germain. Let's go to Al here, because he's got a heron story, I believe.
Excellent.
Yeah. For the first time ever, and I've had my property about 30 years up here, I saw a heron not on my pier, not along the shore, but standing next to my deer feeder.
Mm-hmm.
And a chipmunk happened to be there, and the heron moved to approach the chipmunk, but the chipmunk got away. But my neighbor, just a few doors north, claims that her chipmunk population has gone down drastically because, and she has seen, they have seen a heron take a chipmunk off the ground.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm here on Pickerel Lake in St. Germain.
Yeah.
Well, this represents the third or fourth such observation, Al, and in some cases multiple chipmunks. So I'm not sure whether the herons are getting together on the rookery and discussing this tactic or not, but it seems to work.
One thing that we did do, we called either the DNR or the Northwoods Animal Hospital up here in Minocqua.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, no, they don't take chipmunks.
Oh, yes, they do.
Oh, yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Yes.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you.
And Lee in Okochee, on to you. Hi, Lee.
Good morning. Just wondering, I had a sighting on Lake Okochee of a freshwater jellyfish. I wonder if you could give me any info on it.
Freshwater jellyfish. Scott is thinking hard.
Yeah, I'm trying to think here. I mean, there are a couple of... there are a couple of things here that come to mind, and I'm trying to think of whether I'm drawing a blank on the jellyfish issue. In the past, when we've dealt with this, I mean, there are other things involved that are gelatinous. There are, of course, amphibian egg masses. There are algal colonies. I think it's freshwater sponges that are sometimes gelatinous. But there are a couple of things. Can you describe it a little better, Lee? Did you see, capture this thing or what?
Yes. It's about the size of a dime.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the movement of a jellyfish,
mm-hmm.
and the little tentacles drifting behind. When I looked it up on the Internet, it said that they do exist, and that whatever they use to feed, they can't penetrate human skin.
Uh-huh.
So they're not dangerous or anything, and I guess the bluegills like to eat them.
Well, it's certainly a pretty cool observation.
Yeah.
I've not seen one personally. I was aware that they existed, but maybe we've got an invertebrate zoologist out there who's listening who can fill us in on.
Yeah.
I want to say there was an article in the DNR magazine sometime in the last few years that talked about these things, but I just can't remember the details, Lee. But thanks for bringing it up, and often the listeners can set us straight on this.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Larry and Barron, hello to you. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning or good afternoon, wherever you are. Yeah, I'm in Barron County, and I've been having a sighting of a deer, a doe deer that's coming in single, no fawn, and it is losing its hair. It's reddish hair, and you can count all the ribs on its body, and its back hips are showing. And I was wondering, is that CW up here?
Well, Larry, I think what you're seeing is just the normal seasonal molt that we talked about a little while ago, where they do lose their thin orange-red coat, and the gray or browner hair starts to come in for the winter. That's the likely explanation. But if you thought the deer looked debilitated at all, or was really unusually skinny, or having trouble moving, then no CWD or chronic wasting disease has been found anywhere near you, but it's enough to make you nervous. You should call your local DNR folks about that.
Please do that. Thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, talking the world of wildlife. Thanks for listening in. Join in with your questions. Kathy's online from Minocqua. So let's go to Kathy first. Kathy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. Great show.
Thank you.
Great listening. You were talking earlier about the chipmunks and the blue herons taking care of that population. This summer earlier, we had a blue heron on our shoreline that we saw consuming a baby muskrat.
Wow. Wow.
It doesn't seem like they limit their diet to chipmunks and baby fish.
Oh, I think once they have a taste for mammals, anything they can choke down is fair game.
And choking down was exactly what it was, too.
Yep.
It was crazy. I wanted to ask Scott, do we have somebody in Wisconsin that is our go-to person as far as eagle count and the success of nesting pairs?
I think if you wanted to have the update on how many eagle pairs we have and what success is, kind of look at the information, I think you could contact the Bureau of Endangered Resources at the DNR here in Madison, and they would have ready access to the data and could steer you to a couple of people who could provide you with that. Up in the, where were you located?
Minocqua.
Mercer Lake and Minocqua.
Okay,
then we have two breeding pairs there.
But I think in terms of the local situation up there, the go-to person for me would be the wildlife manager in Rhinelander, Ron Eckstein.
Okay.
Ron's a great guy. He has a lot of personal experience with eagles. He does a lot of things for us with the university, with our field camps and tours and whatnot. And as far as the local scene up in that area, Ron knows it very, very well.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Scott, I want to go back to helgramites for just a minute.
Yeah, just so we don't look like a couple of boneheads, we have to tread on Phil Pelletieri's turf here for a moment. I use the term helgramite to describe dragonfly nymphs.
Yes.
Which, around the Madison area, where that's a very popular bait for perch fishing on the Madison
Especially
lakes.
Especially perch.
If you go into a bait shop and ask for helgramites, that's what you're going to get, is a dozen dragonfly nymphs for an outrageous amount of money. But in any event, but the true helgramite from an entomological standpoint is a Dobson fly larvae. And I used to catch those too back in New England again. These are creatures that are in fast flowing streams. They're underneath the rocks and whatnot. And we used to catch them by one guy would dislodge the rocks and then these would float downstream and get caught on a screen that the other guy was holding. And they too were fabulous bait for bass, but they're black and kind of squiggly looking and have very powerful jaws, and which they use. So you have to handle them carefully. But the Dobson fly larvae is the true helgramite. The term is, however, applied to dragonfly nymphs in areas where there are popular fishing bait. So I'm really glad we had a chance to clear that up before any more emails come in.
All right. Let's go to Patricia in Washburn County next. Hi, Patricia.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'm curious about something that I see at the end of a culvert where water is flowing out into Long Lake here in southern Washburn County, and there are sticks sticking down in the ground, and there's a growth on them that is, twice as large as a grapefruit, say, and it seems somewhat gelatinous or soft. On the outside, it's covered with a grayish, greenish, algae-looking stuff. But anyway, every number of sticks that are in the water have this growth around them. Have you any idea what's in it? I haven't pierced it to see if things what comes out of it.
We talked about this a little bit earlier on submergent sticks and whatnot. I mean, that's a common deposition site for a variety of different egg masses, which can be pretty large and globular, although it's getting late in the year for those. I mean, that should have been a spring phenomenon. And they do attract growths of algae and so forth on the outer surfaces. But again, if we get some invertebrate zoologist to contact us and square away the freshwater sponges and bryozoans and other such things that would have that basic form, maybe we can get a better answer for you.
Yeah, stay listening. Okay. Stay listening.
Stand by.
Let's go to Paul. Paul, hello.
Hi. Hey, look, about your jellyfish sightings, I've been diving since 1965. 18 of those years have been here in Wisconsin. And I have seen this critter in Red Granite Quarry.
Mm-hmm.
And I did take a couple pictures. If your biologist is interested in, if he's got an email address, I can get it out of my database and send it to him.
Sure. That'd be great.
You could send those in. Some of these things that come in that are of interest to the audience, I think Larry puts on his
Facebook page.
So, sure, that'd be great.
In fact, that'd be great if you'd post that to my Facebook page. It's my radio station Facebook page is titled The Larry Mueller Show.
The Larry Mueller Show. Sure, I wouldn't mind at all.
Oh, well, that'd be great.
I think I still have those pictures.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it. Oh, that's good, fun. So do that soon. I'd love to see those.
Can't beat a photograph when you're trying to confirm something.
That's exactly right. Brian and Hazel Green, we're going to go on to you now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Good.
Larry and Scott, thank you for taking my call. Great show as always. About a year ago, in probably the third week of August, we were up at Merrick State Park on the Mississippi River there. And I'd say it was between 5 and 6 in the evening. We were getting ready to, sit down and go and eat. And out of the blue, just thousands and thousands of small gnats or, what have you, that were ever roaming the sky, fell to their death onto the ground. Now, I'm wondering, I've seen those things on Discovery where there was methane gas from, like, ponds and stuff or, large lakes. Now, could there have been a methane gas phenomenon?
Hmm.
I've only seen it once, and I'll probably never see it again, but it was strange. Now, I wouldn't have believed it if it was just me, but it was my wife and my children as well.
So all of a sudden, scads of these little insects just fell dead.
Fell, exactly.
Huh. Yep. Well, I can't speak to the methane gas issue, but a lot of these aquatic insects that emerge in tremendous numbers have a very, very short lifespan. I mean, sometimes measured in hours or a day or two. And I could only imagine, you know, large numbers of these things clinging to vegetation or whatnot and essentially dead. And then all of a sudden, you know, gust of wind or something and boom, they're raining down. I'm not sure what to tell you, Brian. It's an interesting thing to see, and certainly anybody familiar with the Northwoods Lakes is well aware of these emergence of lake flies, lake midges, mayflies, what have you, when it can just clouds of these things, especially in areas where it's kind of in the lee of a point or an island or something, and they're out of the wind. But why they'd all fall dead all of a sudden, I have no speculation other than what you've already offered yourself. However, this is a case where, again, I don't know if Phil's listening, but the next time Phil Pelletieri's on, I would not hesitate to call in for a moment and pose that question to Phil.
Absolutely. Thanks. And please do that, Brian. Stay listening. Phil will be on. I don't have the exact date, but he'll be on again soon. I wanted to go back to Operation Deer Watch for just a minute, Scott, because apparently that is really off to a good start, and maybe you could explain what that is.
Well, there are a couple of things that have just been kicked off literally in the last few weeks that have caught on. One of them we mentioned on the program the first part of August, and that was the ability of folks in the Northwoods who were concerned about wolf activity as a potential threat to pets, hunting dogs, or what have you, that they could subscribe to a DNR service where essentially they'd receive email notification that while this particular pack is very active or there's been a dog attack in such and such an area. And interestingly enough, just since this was posted, 3,400 dog trainers, pet owners, hunters, and so forth have signed up for the service to allow them to keep track of wolf activity. So that apparently was a very popular thing to do. And I think if other listeners are interested in that, you can get on the DNR website and search for dog depredation by wolves and then follow the simple instructions for subscribing to the alerts. And you can unsubscribe whenever you want. So that caught on. Likewise, Operation Deer Watch, which is going to run, I think, through September 30th and kicked off October 1st, has already had about 2,000 deer observations submitted.
August 1st it started.
August 1st. It started August 1st. It will end the end of September. So about 2,000 observations have come in, and the state's wildlife managers were, this was simply a matter of encouraging citizens to join the effort at any time by clicking on the Operation Deer Watch button, again, on the DNR website. And they're asking people to submit observations of how many does and bucks and fawns and other things they're seeing. Since that kicked off, let's see, over the 4 weeks, according to this release, observers have reported 564 bucks, 497 unknowns, 1,226 does without fawns, 415 fawns without does, 493 does with one fawn, and on up the line with multiple fawns. But I think the interesting thing was the preliminary analysis of those observations shows a statewide fawn to doe ratio of 0.88. And over time, and this is from DNR collected information, the statement here is that the 50-year statewide average is 0.86.
So it's pretty accurate.
It's pretty darn good. So this is all information which is helpful in terms of the DNR setting deer regulations and understanding what's going on with deer reproduction, which is important in future harvests. So, hey, you still got 30 days to contribute.
So go to the website. Take a look. Jackie in Milwaukee, we're on to you. Hi, Jackie.
I've got two questions. One, where do you call if you have some kind of a question when he is not on the air?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other one is, I have seen an animal. My dog alerted it to at the bottom of it's the infamous Lincoln Creek where all the water came up, and it I thought it might have been a ferret because it was long, black, and humped its back when it ran. But my neighbor said he had seen it last year before winter. Can a mink be in this area? Would a ferret live through the winter?
Well, let's take the ferret mink issue first. It is highly likely that the animal you're seeing, especially in a wet environment, is a mink.
Beautiful black.
They're a beautiful animal, obviously. I mean, mink is mink. It's a highly desirable fur and so forth. So, yeah, beautiful animal. They are elongated. They do have kind of a humpy, irregular run when they move. And a ferret, generally a domestic ferret or something that's escaped or been released, is more of a blonde color and has darker extremities, and they probably would have trouble making it through the winter. So I think you're just seeing a native mink, period.
Whole black, absolutely gorgeous. My dog went crazy, and the way it went. Now, is that unusual in the Milwaukee Northwest area?
No, not at all. Mink are reasonably common. There are mink right here along the Lakeshore Path on Lake Mendota on campus. So what is a little unusual, if you describe it as coal black, I mean, the normal wild coloration is a deep, rich chocolate brown with a little white blaze on their throat.
At a
distance, or depending on the light, they would certainly appear very dark. Yeah. There are many mink operations in the state where mink are raised commercially on mink farms, and black is a fairly common domestic color phase, and these animals do escape periodically and show up in strange places. But
okay, and what about the number that you would call when I don't want to bother you?
Well, I mean the extension people, and there are three of us on campus. I mean, when I'm not on the radio, I'm still answering questions from people all the time, either by phone or email. Depending on your question, the starting point is often the local county extension office with most common questions. That would be the starting point. And additionally, if it's a question that deals with problems or nuisance wildlife kinds of things, occasionally those are directed toward the USDA's Wildlife Services offices in Sun Prairie, Waupun, and Rhinelander. And then there are private contractors who handle all sorts of wildlife issues and concerns as well. So there, and again, for general kinds of informational questions, there are numerous nature centers in the Milwaukee and Waukesha County area where you'd call places like the Retzer Nature Center or the Todd Weir Nature Center, and their naturalists can help you with most common local questions, and they're often more knowledgeable about what's going on in your community than I would be, or someone at the state level. So there's lots of places to get your help.
Well, and there's a lot of stuff going on in our area. Thank you, dear.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We've got some new hunting and trapping rules this fall, Scott.
Yes, there are several things. Of course, as we move along here, we mentioned that this morning represented the opening of both the dove and early goose season. And then, of course, there'll be another big day coming up on, is it the 16th? Let me see here. Well, it's either the 16th. Anyway, mid-September is another big opener, which marks the opening of the grouse in the Northwoods, the archery deer season, the squirrel season, turkey season, and for some of the bear hunting opportunity. I'm just trying to figure out whether that was the 16th or 18th, but I don't have that here in front of me. In any event, there are some new regulations that hunters should be aware of. Most of the newer rules can be found on the What's New section of the Fall Seasons Regulations pamphlets that all hunters will receive when they get a license. And there's a fact sheet available online on the Hunting and Trapping Regulations page of the DNR website. However, a couple of them that I highlighted. Historically in Wisconsin, when you were an archery hunter, and that opens up fairly quickly, you got an antlerless deer carcass, and I think you still will. But for the first time that I can recall, those antlerless permits will not be valid. You cannot take an antlerless deer with a bow in 19 deer management units primarily in the northeastern corner of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an area where it was determined that the herd really needed to be rebuilt, and the bow hunters chipped in with their part and supported the notion that there would be no antlerless deer harvest in those units, including bow hunters. So that's something to be careful about depending on where you're hunting. Another thing that's been batted around for some time was the use of scopes or telescopic sights on muzzle loaders. That is now legal, beginning with the muzzleloader season, which is at the end of November. Whole deer carcasses can now be moved around in and out of the CWD area with some restrictions, but anybody who's hunting in that area should become aware of those restrictions. Deer and bear may now be quartered for easier removal from the field, so you don't have to drag the whole carcass out. You can legally quarter them, and there are a few other things, as well as the normal seasonal variation in waterfowl regulations, you know, how many ducks and where in different zones and so forth. Most hunters are well aware that they need to check the regulations pamphlet before they head out.
Jill emailed us and said, people have told me that twins are not common, very common in deer. She attached a photo, which I don't have. I don't have the photo, but I got the email. It says, these two deer and their respective sets of twins are enjoying our garden. Is that unusual or just...
Twins are actually very common, and even triplets, quadruplets, and I think we have a couple records in the literature of up to five, but nevertheless, twins are quite common. And when... Also on an email, I remember we did have one. I just wanted to say something about that bat email.
Yeah.
There was a concern that bats are not getting enough food when they enter into hibernation in the fall, and therefore they're out flying around in the winter looking for food. I think the real issue there as far as bats having to emerge in the winter from their caves or mines or wherever they are is the current concern over a disease problem called white nose syndrome, which causes the bats to arouse during the winter and forage outside, in which case they're doomed.
Yeah.
So there's great concern that white nose syndrome, which was just discovered in 2006, not very long ago, in upstate New York, has already spread as far as Missouri, and some of our bats are moving in that particular corridor. So there's a great deal of concern that white nose could show up in Wisconsin as early as this winter. And there's some real concern that that could decimate some of our local bat populations. So that's the bigger problem. It's not a matter of food resources. If the bats can't get enough to eat this year with the insect populations we have, then they're never going to be fat and healthy. So that's the concern.
And back to those two does with their respective sets of twins in the garden. Jill, if you wouldn't mind posting that to my Facebook page, I'm sure a lot of people would like to see that as well. Actually, we enjoy the wildlife photos, and if you've got some cool wildlife photos and you don't mind posting them, I'd love to have you post them on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So just go to the Larry Mueller Show And if you don't mind posting them, we'd love to have them.
It might not be the most popular picture, but an image of one of these herons lugging a chipmunk back to the lake,
I suspect
would attract some attention as well.
I would love to have that, too. Oh, boy. Judith in Madison. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a question. I live by a creek, and I've been seeing really, really small birds, maybe the size of a, what do you call the little birds? I don't know if they're finches. They're really like bright lime green with orange, like a little bit of orange on them.
Bright lime green. Mm-hmm. And how many of these?
20 of them.
In Madison?
Yes.
And you did say birds.
Mm-hmm. They're little birds.
Bright lime green.
Well, a little bird that's bright lime green with any color, I mean, the only thing that comes to mind is
parakeet.
A ruby-throated hummingbird or something that's been released or what have you. I'm not sure what to tell you about this one.
Could be ruby-throated hummingbird. You're right.
I mean, with the proper lighting, they are a bright green, and you do see the iridescent red on the throat, at least on the males, and they are tiny, but... there's just not much out there in our... If you get to tropical birds, there are all sorts of bright lime green ones, but around here, not so much. So I'm not sure what to tell you there. That might be something we'd like to see a picture of or email,
if you can get a picture,
send in some more information.
Send a picture in. And probably a ruby-throated hummingbird. We had one other person who had a huge toad living on the deck. The nearest pond is 3/4 of a mile away. Diane says, would he appreciate a ride to the pond?
No, not this time of year. He's probably very happy on your deck or next to the garage door where it's catching bugs that are attracted to your nightlight or whatever. Toads can cover a lot of ground and are not as dependent on water as the rest of the amphibians. So best thing for that toad is to let him do his thing right where he is.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks. You'll be back the first you're going to be back on the 22nd.
Oh, the 22nd, yes. Three of us are on to talk about the new Bird Eek book.
Yep. Yeah, so we'll have him on the 22nd of September. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.